out of sight.net presents popular book narrator Scott Brick, hosted by Rich DeSteno at our 9th birthday celebration on January 28th, 2017.
This is Rich DeSteno from Out of Sight with noted narrator Scott Brick. Many of us are familiar with Scott's work, and we're very proud and happy to have Scott with us today. Scott, thanks so much for giving your time to come on to spend some time with us here today on our 9th birthday.
Oh, thank you, Rich. I didn't realize it was your 9th birthday. That's fabulous. How wonderful. It's a privilege to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Can you just give us a little bit of, you know, your background, where you're from, and that sort of thing?
Sure. I'm a California boy. I was born and raised in Southern California. Born in Santa Barbara, raised primarily in Los Angeles. I went to UCLA as a theater major, and when I left school, I did about 10 years on and off traveling in a Shakespeare company all around the state, and I'd always been passionate about old-time radio, and the closest thing that we have to that in terms of storytelling nowadays is audiobooks. And so I kept asking my agent to, get me an audiobook gig, get me an audiobook audition. And she didn't know how. I probably should mention this as an old agent. I finally, as it turns out, there was a buddy of mine that I had gone to UCLA with, and we played baseball every week, every Saturday. And come to find out, he was working for an audiobook company for Dove Audio, which was still going at the time, sadly, there. They went out of business shortly thereafter, but he got me my first audition, and it's been a wonderful ride ever since.
And what year did you start narrating books?
I tell you, I actually know the first date. I wrote it down in my my date book. It was June 10th, 1999, okay. And I remember that date only because several people in my life, they threw me a surprise party on my 10th anniversary.
Fantastic.
So that was nice.
So when you started initially narrating books, did you receive training, or were you on your own, or did the company have certain procedures to how to do it?
Well, basically what they look for is, the training that you receive is really the acting training that you've had throughout your career in school and then in practice. And the training is essentially on-the-job training. You are told, look, there's a microphone, and it picks up everything, the subtlest inflection. And so what we're warned about is that, when you're on the stage or in front of the camera, you can convey so much with body language. I'd say 90% of acting, as most of us are familiar with it, is done visually. And yet the challenge is to do that only using the voice. So there was a lot of hit and miss at the beginning, a lot of practice and experimentation, and there wasn't any kind of specific training I had to do at the time. Nowadays, actually, we offer that. I've been brought back by UCLA, my alma mater. They've brought me back to actually offer a course in audiobook narration to the theater department graduate students. It's actually the first one of its kind in America. It's a real kick being back in my old stomping grounds and now helping train newer, younger actors
I can imagine. It must
to
be
get into the business.
A thrill to meet the younger people and bring them into the
industry. Yeah, absolutely.
Is it safe to say that you work for different companies now as the jobs may come up?
Absolutely. Today I'm actually coming to you live from Penguin Random House's studio in Woodland Hills. We're finishing up a Clive Cussler book today. But this coming week, I'm doing a book for directly for an author, and then that's only about a 2-day gig. And then right after that, I do something for Macmillan Audio, and I just finished something for Harper last week. So, we're most audiobook narrators, with very rare exceptions, are independent contractors, and we float from publisher to publisher. We basically will follow the author. Nelson DeMille, I know that you spoke with him
right
earlier. He started his career for many, many years at Grand Central, but now he's moving to Simon & Schuster. Okay. There have been many authors that I've as they move from one publisher to another, I'll go with them.
Fantastic. Now, is there pretty much a standard schedule that a narrator has to, during a day, a number of hours, or during a week? How does that work?
In general, yes. In practice, it's different for every narrator, depending on his or her other commitments and family life. I know some narrators have other jobs. You know, some do it part-time, some do it full-time. A very good friend of mine, Eric Martin, he was a student of mine years ago, and now he's a dear friend. He works at Universal Studios. He does the casting for the theme park. So depending on your commitments, you know, you can tailor your schedule. In the basic sense, we try to get, if you're a full-time, like myself, you try to get 3 finished hours a day. And that takes maybe 6 hours in the studio, maybe it's 8 hours in the studio. But when it's edited down, it becomes 3 finished hours of the product that you listen to. Most books nowadays, I think the average book is 11 hours. So we spend about 22 hours in the studio to get that done. You know, if you're going at a good rate and not, you know, pushing too hard, you can get about 3 hours done a day, 5 days a week. That's about 15 hours of a finished product. So, you know, maybe you're working from 9 to 5. Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Kafer is a good friend of mine. He's got a family, so he'll do a split schedule. He'll record while his kids are in school. Then they come home, and, you know, then he goes back to it after they've been picked up and taken care of. And so he does a split schedule, a bit in the morning and a bit in the evening.
Now, I'm curious about to what extent do the powers that may be at that company, or the editors, or whoever the people in that position are, to what extent do they come back to you and say, can you do this part over, or read this again with a different type of inflection? Any significant amount of that?
You know, I think at the beginning of your career, yes, but typically that's why you have a director in the booth with you. So if you go really off track, and let's say you do the wrong accent, and they say, you know, actually this guy isn't really from Glasgow. He was born and raised in Brooklyn, so you might want to change the accent. That's why we have a director, hopefully, in the booth with us, so they can guide us and prevent us from making any egregious mistakes. But I will tell you that every single book that you have ever listened to has had multiple retakes that needed doing. They'll come to you and they'll say, you know, it's typically an error made just by glancing at something. You make certain assumptions. You look at the word begin. Those exact same 5 letters, if you switch them around, it's the word being. And, you know, the eye sees it, the brain interprets it sometimes mistakenly. So, Kata Mazur, she's a wonderful narrator. She did The Nanny Diaries and many, many other classics. She tells this funny story. She said one time the director came to her, they were recording, and then she hears the crackle of the talk back, the microphone coming in from the booth, and you hear this, Kata, could you redo that line? Oh, which line? The line about the shooting spree that took out 20 people. And Kata says, oh, I thought I got that one right. Yeah, no. Really? I was pretty sure I got, no, just if you could take it again. There's a pause, and she says, well, what did I say? And the director says, you said a shopping spree that killed 20 people. And Kata said, well, that's because I've been on shopping sprees that killed 20 people.
If it's Christmas Eve, it could be true, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. So it's little things like that. That happens all the time. I will say, I one time got direction from an author via email, and it came to us as I was on the second page of the book, and it couldn't have been timed more perfectly, because I read this book. It was called, the author was John Twelvehawks, and the book was called Spark, and it was an ingenious thriller almost science fiction, very cutting edge. It was essentially, it was about somebody who had had a brain injury in a traffic accident, and he had, if I'm remembering the name right, Cotard syndrome, which is very rare, but you believe that you're dead. So essentially, his humanity had been wiped clean with this one car accident, and then he had been manipulated into becoming a hitman, the perfect hitman, because he would have no remorse.
Wow.
So anyway, as I'm reading this, and I'm reading it, it's all told in the first person, and I thought, oh, this is Man Without Emotion. It's Mr. Spock. It's almost like I didn't want to do it in a monotone, but I thought, you know, maybe kind of a Spock-like cadence. And the director stopped me and said, you know, we just got an email from the author. Listen to this. And the author, John Twelvehawks, shared, and I had done three of his books before, and he always had wonderful input, but on this one he said, please let Scott know that the important thing about the character isn't that he's lost his humanity. It's that he's trying to find it again. And that just opened things up for me, and I realized, no, he's not Spock. He's just like an innocent child.
Right, right.
You know, it was really wonderful to get feedback like that. But it's usually while we're making it, not after the fact.
Well, I personally, and I think a lot of blind people listen to books exclusively, of course, but I really enjoy a book much more when the narrator does attempt to do authentic accents for people who may be from a different country, or do different inflections for different characters. Now, I just happened, this is total coincidence, because I didn't even know when I downloaded this book about 2 weeks ago. It turned out to be a book read by you. And I think it was called Duty and Honor.
That sounds familiar, and
It's under the name of Clancy, but then it has another author, you know, has an author.
Yes. Maybe it was Mark Graney. Duty and Honor. Yes, it's one of the Clancy books written after Clancy passed away.
Right.
Yes,
and
I remember that.
This book had at least one character who was a European. He's a journalist, and then the American guy got hooked up with him, and they were after the American guy who was the son of the U.S. president. And anyway. Your accent, you know, the accent that you attributed to this European was so perfect and so convincing that it makes the book just so much more interesting, you know, and so much more believable.
Oh, I'm grateful. Thank you.
It really does. And we get some books we had a lot of books from the National Library Service, and they employ narrators in these, you know, contract companies. And some of them also do that, but then some of them don't. And when I get a book where it's a flat read and everybody is read the same way and there's no accents, and I don't quite enjoy it as much. It's just more difficult to be believable, you know?
Well, I realize, I think in many ways that's the great divide among audiobook listeners, that some want accents, some want to act it out, and others don't. And, you know, to each their own. I'm with you. That's why I narrate the way I do, because when I listen to an audiobook, which I do all the time, that's what I want. That's what I want when somebody tells me a story, and that's what I want to do when I'm telling them a story. So, you know, we go with our instinct. Sometimes you'll read a negative review on Amazon or Audible, and you try not to take it personally, because it's like, well, that person doesn't want what I do. And I understand that. So,
well, here's something I've always wondered, though. When you get a book where you're going to have accents, maybe it's an Asian accent, a European accent, or Italian, German, Spanish, whatever it may be, and then you're going to use slightly different voices for different characters. How do you plan that out? I mean, that has to be so planned and so orchestrated. It seems to me that that's a very, very daunting task.
Well, I'll tell you, the one thing that we do when we sit down with a manuscript, even before we start reading it, especially now that the manuscripts come to us in a PDF rather than, you know, I used to get a stack of, if it was like a James Clavell novel, I remember John Lee recording one years ago, and the stack of pages the manuscript pages was over a foot tall. And now that we have a PDF that we can search for, the very first thing I do is I go into the search box and I look for, and I plug in the word accent or voice.
Mm-hmm.
And any reference that they give me, whether it describes an accent or just the timbre of their voice. My favorite description of a voice ever, and I want to say it was in Raymond Chandler, but I don't quote me on that. It said this character had a voice like cigarettes and low shelf booze. And I just love that. So that's what we look for, certainly, but a lot of authors don't give you anything about the voice.
Yeah.
So it becomes an interpretation. So, well, I'll look at things like, well, you know, male or female, certainly, to differentiate it. I'll also look for things like which character is the one who drives the action?
Mm-hmm.
Which is the one who always seems to know where they're going and that the other ones follow? Because the other characters are going to be inquisitive. You know, hey, Quinn, what do you think? You know, is it going to be this? No, I'm pretty sure it's going to be this.
Mm-hmm.
Because one, when they're inquisitive, they're kind of going up at the end of those sentences. The other one's declarative, he's just saying how it's going to be, and goes down at the end of those two, at the end of his sentences. So really just doing that helps the listener differentiate who's who.
Now,
do
you have to read the whole thing through before you read it as a recording, and do you mark it up at all?
Yeah, you definitely want to read ahead of time. I'll admit that occasionally our schedule is such that I can't ahead of time, but in those cases, I'm always working with somebody who has. So I have gone into books completely cold because, you know, that maybe there was a problem with the author or the publisher, or maybe it's just my schedule that's so crazed. But I, you know, for sometimes I'll get it last minute, but I'm working with somebody who has read it, who knows exactly what he or she is doing, and, you know, then I can just be completely led. They take me by the hand and they say, again, like I said earlier, this guy's from Glasgow. This guy is from Brooklyn. This guy's from Atlanta. And if you're doing a mystery, if it's a whodunit, you have to know whodunit. You just do.
Mm-hmm.
Because an author is, especially in that genre, if it's a whodunit, there's always going to be the red herring, the misleading suspect,
right.
The one you think is the bad guy, but then you've got the one who really did it, and so I'm like, okay, well, I know that the red herring is the one I have to play a little, maybe a bit more coarse, a bit more unfriendly, unlikable, and the real killer I have to play mild as mother's milk, so it's a real surprise
right.
He or she is revealed, and if we haven't done our research ahead of time, then we're not helping the author or the listener. You have to know why the author does what they do, so you can help them do what they do.
Right.
And mislead the listener if necessary.
Well, I saw some article on the internet, and I saw that your favorite genre is science fiction. Is that right?
I love science fiction, and I love old noirish thrillers, like, you know, the hard-boiled detective.
I read
those two genres voraciously.
Well, I used to be a big fan of science fiction, but I kind of separate science fiction where you take real-life situations, but there's something weird that happens because somebody has a power that, you know, it's seemingly a regular person, but suddenly they have a superpower or they make things happen.
Right.
But there were other books that I've come across where it's so bizarre, I can't even relate to it. Like the creatures that have very strange body formations,
yeah.
And you know they fly around, and I don't know. When it gets too crazy, I can't quite get into it.
Yeah, to me the former situation you were describing, that's my favorite too. That's more like speculative fiction rather than science fiction. I think my favorite science fiction is the kind where you almost don't notice what makes it science fiction. You know, what makes the Ender's Game series so wonderful is that it's about the people rather than the science.
Right.
You know, it wasn't hard sci-fi. It was always the interpersonal relationships.
Right.
That's what drags you. That's what brings you in. That's what hooks you.
That's the stuff
I
like.
Yeah, fascinating, but not the hook.
Now, we referred earlier to Nelson DeMille, and I got hooked on his stuff earlier in 2016, and I just went through book after book, and I came across, near the end of my string of reading his books, I came across a book that was read by you. And at the beginning of this book, I saw that I hope I'm remembering this right, because I'm going by memory, but I saw that the reading time was 28 hours. And I never, ever would have gone beyond, say, 15 hours on a book, because I always feel like, oh, this is way too long. But because I liked the previous Nelson DeMille books I read, and I was going to give it a shot. It turned out to be Up Country, which you read.
Yes.
And
I remember.
Man, I got to tell you, your reading of that lengthy interplay between Paul Brenner and Susan Weber, the woman expatriate American, where they were traveling through Vietnam, and he was trying to figure out who she was or what she was. And she was playing a little bit of a game with him, but then, you know, you didn't know if she really fell in love with him. And then they confronted this Colonel Mang, this angry old North Vietnamese, you know, official. And your reading of this woman's voice in the inflections of the conversations they had was just so, you know, so fantastic. I'm not just soaping you up, I'm telling you. It was really so fantastic that I never felt that this book's too long, I can't take this long conversation. It was really, really enthralling to hear how you presented the inflection of this woman and the interplay with Paul Brenner, who often had these temper tantrums and things like that, you know? So that I got to really commend you on that. That was absolutely fantastic reading.
I have to say I'm so grateful to hear that, because I have extremely fond memories of that book in particular. That was the second Nelson DeMille book I'd ever done. The first was his previous book, The Lion's Game. And recording that book was special for many reasons. We recorded that book the month after the attacks in New York.
Oh,
I flew
wow.
to New York on, yeah, we, I flew there on 10/11,
oh,
exactly
wow.
1 month after the attacks. And it took almost 3 weeks, maybe a little over 2 weeks to record. I lived back east for just 3 weeks as we finished it, and you know, spending that time in the city was a very humanizing experience on many levels. But that was also the first book where I felt like I was being trusted implicitly by the author, because that was the first time that an author had said, I want to make sure Scott reads this book, because I had read his previous book, Nelson's previous book, The Lion's Game, as I said. And he specifically arranged to have me put on that book. And I felt trusted. I felt like I'd been trusted with a gift, with his creation, and that he was saying, I trust what you do with this. And it was really the beginning of my relationship with Nelson, and that has been one of the great joys of my professional career. Nelson, I know you spoke with him earlier. Nelson is the most generous man in publishing, which is saying something, because publishing is peopled by some very, very generous individuals. I have never met anybody as extraordinary as he. Let me tell you what happened. The way I first was introduced to him, not personally, that was years later, but our first interaction came about because about a year or so after The Lion's Game came out, it was kind of at the dawn of, certainly the dawn of my audiobook career, but it was as audiobooks were starting to break wide into a wider audience in America. And I got a piece of snail mail that Nelson had received. It was saying that they liked they loved the book, The Lion's Game, but they really enjoyed the experience of listening to it. He Xeroxed that, sent it to the publisher and said, would you please make sure this gets to Scott Brick, because I think he deserves it as much as I do. And I thought, that's really, that's going a bit far. Nelson did the hard, he did the heavy lifting. He wrote it, I just read it.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it was a very gracious thing to do. It had his email address, so I sent him an email to say thank you. And he wrote back saying he expressed an interest at that time when we first spoke via email that I would do his upcoming book, Upcountry. And as generous as that was for him to send me that email, it was the first of 1,000 times since. It's no exaggeration. Over the years, a new book would come out and I would get just a flood of forwarded emails by his two assistants, who are marvelous in his office. And they make sure that any time an email comes through or a comment on his website, they forward it to me if it has anything to do with the audio. And I thought, that's extraordinary, not just that he did it the first time. No other author has ever done that.
Yeah, yeah.
But not only did they do it the first time, they've done it every time since.
Wow.
And I just, my gosh, they're wonderful people.
Well, it's very encouraging when you meet somebody who's, you know, successful and famous like he is, and he agreed to, you know, be interviewed by us and spend some time with us today. And we're nothing. And he was just so relaxed and generous with the information and so forthcoming today. It was a pleasure to do it. And in anticipation of that interview, I had gone on YouTube the last week or so, and he's got several interviews there. And I said, wow, this is a really down-to-earth guy. And he comes through every time you hear him. He's a really down-to-earth, relaxed, unassuming guy, and he's just open and eager to be cooperative and helpful.
Absolutely, and I just focus on one word that you said. You said, oh, well, we're nobody. Nobody is nobody to Nelson DeMille.
Exactly.
Everybody who has ever read one of his books, he is grateful, and he expresses that. And I'll tell you, one of the most remarkable things that ever happened to me in my career, it happened as something I just got to witness. We went to a festival, a reading festival, in Fort Myers, Florida. And it was funny. Nelson says, you know, we usually vacation there every year, but I don't usually go to the festival. We just, you know, I spend the time with my family.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, but they asked me if I would come this year, and I said, well, I tell you what, Scott, if you go, I'll go. I said, absolutely. So they brought me out there to essentially, we did two things. I think we did two panels. One where they interviewed me about how do you make audiobooks? Katie Kellgren, another narrator, lovely, wonderful friend of mine, she and I went and did that panel. But on this other panel, they brought me there to essentially interview Nelson DeMille in front of a live audience. So we had met many times before, and again, always been such a lovely guy, he and his entire family. And in this circumstance, though, there were a number of older gentlemen, some in wheelchairs, others walking with a cane or with a crutch, and some wearing the insignia of their rank of service in Vietnam. They were Vietnam veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were having this introductory dinner the night before the festival began, these gentlemen got up, moved to the microphone, and they were all seated at Nelson's table. It was across the room from me. And I just remember hearing so much laughter and looking over and seeing so many smiles. And these gentlemen got up, went to the microphone, and said they were the surviving members of Nelson's company.
Oh, wow.
I don't quote me on this, I believe he was a sergeant. And he was essentially, at one point, he was in charge of them while they were in Vietnam. He said that they were there to thank him for bringing them home safely in Vietnam and to present him with this saber, with this sword.
Wow!
From kind of like a cavalry sword, that kind of thing. And they were presenting him as a sword as a gift to say thank you for bringing them home safely. And I tell you what, I felt so privileged to have been there and witnessed that. And so the next day when we were doing the interview, there they all were, and we took a picture beforehand, and there they all were in the front row. And I remember saying to Nelson, you know, at the end of the interview, I thank you for a lot of things over the years, a relationship that means a lot to me, but I've never been able to publicly thank you for your service, but I'm do so now. And it was a wonderful thing to be able to take part in.
Yeah, I can imagine that. That's what, I mean, I lived through the Vietnam War. I wasn't in it, but I mean, those years I remember so well, and the things that those guys went through who were in the service over there is just incredible.
Yeah. That was my childhood. I was born in 66, so I was starting to come of age as they were all coming home, and I can't even imagine. But, yeah.
Well, as we wind down here, I had, in anticipation of this, I had asked some of our members who were interested to do so to send in some questions that they might
Great.
Want to hear answers from you. So I'm just going to go through a couple notes I have here. We have
Sounds good.
One of our prominent members, Mary Kay from Florida, wrote in, and she said, she's asking, which book, if you could say, have you enjoyed reading the most as a narrator?
First of all, thank you, Mary, for sending in the question. I appreciate it. Thank you for listening. That's difficult, a very difficult question, only because at this point I've narrated, I think, I lost track, but I know it's over 800 books at this point. They all, in many ways, they're all special, you know, obviously, but there are others that are more so, first among equals, because like you, I'm a book fan.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ones that stand out, but it's very difficult to narrow them all down to a single one. I kind of go by the genre, you know. All of Nelson's books have been marvelous experiences. I've gotten to know a few authors whose my personal relationship with them has made working on their books even more special. I think of the Dune authors, Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson. Working on that series has been marvelous because I was a huge fan of it long before I was a narrator. Mm-hmm. And then getting to work on it professionally has been hugely rewarding. The same way I've known Orson Scott Card for years, long before I got to narrate his books. And he was my favorite for many, many years, so I love working on his title. But certain books like, you know, Fahrenheit 451, which is very difficult to come by. It's not available on Audible, but it is available in the library.
Mm-hmm.
That was, it's a love letter to literature, you know. It was absolutely extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Getting to narrate In Cold Blood was an absolute thrill and an honor to be trusted with such a modern classic. You know, this last year, about a year, maybe 18 months ago, I was approached to record Jurassic Park, which was a thrill because I had done the sequel at the very beginning of my career.
Yeah, right.
And so we did them out of order, but being trusted to you know, revisit the island again after so many years, they redid all of Michael Crichton's works when the most recent Jurassic Park film came out, when they, you know, revived the franchise. So that was an absolute thrill. There are quite a few books. Then again, there's a little, there's a book that I never expected would affect me the way it did, but it's called The Storied Life of A.J. Sickrey.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm mortified, the author's name. I've never worked on her books before, and I'm mortified that I'm blanking on her name right now. But that was extraordinary. It came to me at a time in my life, I was dealing with some health issues at the time, that came up again in the book. And it's a very short book. I want to say it's only about 8 hours long. So I could have finished that book in less than 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
But I found myself just parceling it out slower. I was moving slower and slower as I got deeper into it because I realized I just didn't want it to end.
Oh, yeah, right.
It was so beautiful. So I worked on that book for 5 days instead of three because I wanted to stay in that world for longer. It was a book about books, about a bookseller.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a marvelous story. Yeah. Gabrielle Zevin. There we are.
Okay.
Gabrielle Zevin. Now I remember the author's name. I'm so embarrassed it took me that long. She was really lovely. She reached out to me afterwards. And I found that book profoundly moving. So.
Well, I think we all people who are avid readers, I think we all have that feeling sometimes when we're really reading a great book. And when it comes to an end, you feel a loss.
You really do. But I remember what a professor of mine at UCLA told me, and it was wonderful. I didn't even know this, that there was a class like this, but the name of the course was Science Fiction Literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as an avid reader, I went in and I remember sitting in one of his lectures, and he was talking about one of my favorite books, which was A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller Jr., written in the 50s, about a post-apocalyptic time when humanity re-emerges from the ashes, and essentially what we know about the life before the apocalypse was in the hands of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was fascinating, a look over 1,000 years as humanity was rising again. And there was a wonderful character, a brother, in the first third of that book. And it was such a marvelous character. And I remember what the professor said to me, the mark of a good character is after you turn the last page, do you wonder what that character is doing now?
Right.
And so that has been the benchmark ever since. And I am blessed that I've been able to work on a lot of books where I still find myself wondering, what is he up to right now? What is she doing? You know,
because they're so real. That, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And A.J. Fickrey is one of those characters for me.
Well, there's just a couple more here. Linda from Maine.
Yeah,
Linda from Maine.
Linda?
Linda, yeah. She has a couple questions. We've covered some of these, so I'm just going to ask you the one that is a little different. Do you have any difficulty switching from voice to voice or accent to accent while you're reading a book?
That's a great question. For the most part, no. 90% of the time, no. But then there are certain accents that are similar. It's very difficult to go back and forth. You know, Irish and Scottish, they both have a rhythm and a cadence. And at times they've got, very similar accents. The Cockney accent from England and the Australian accent, oh my gosh. And I say that my girlfriend is Australian, so I can hear those similarities. And my gosh, sometimes I'll be doing a Cockney accent and going, "No, gosh, you're doing Australian. Stop it." And crazily enough, there are similarities in the Spanish accent and a Russian accent, which seem very different, but there are certain vowels and consonants that are done the same way, and I'll find myself, if I've done a Russian accent and then I have to switch into a Spanish or Mexican or whatever, there's some kind of Latino language that where I'm like, oh God, and I have to stop and remind myself of a certain phrase where I can hear it in my head.
Right.
And go, okay, now I got it. Great, ready to go.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, shift gears like that. That takes a lot of concentration.
Yeah.
We have Bob from Texas. He says, do you do any recreational reading?
Bob, that's a great question. You know, for many years I didn't, only because I didn't have time. But then I realized life is too short. And look, like you, like everybody who is a book fan, there are books I love, and then there are books I really don't love. And I was working on too many books in a row that I just didn't love.
Mm-hmm, right.
And so I had to go and revisit my loves again. And so, yes, I listen to audiobooks all the time. When I come out here to Penguin Random House, where I am right now, I live about 20 minutes away. And those 20 minutes, I treasure it in the car, because I, you know, I can listen to something. And my God, my Audible queue is huge. I've got, seriously, over Christmas, I had to erase a bunch of titles from my cell phone because I couldn't take pictures on Christmas Day anymore because my phone was full of so many Audible titles. But I've also, rediscovered the joys of a hard copy book, which I know not everybody is able to enjoy, but it's just that the smell of the pulp, you know, the pages, the tactile feeling of the pages under my fingers is wonderful. And my favorite movie of all time was Casablanca. So when I was in a bookstore, a secondhand store recently, I found a marvelous biography of Humphrey Bogart. So I went, and it was about 600 pages, and I only had a few minutes a day to devote to it. It took me about 6 months, but you know, by God, when I finished that book and I shut that last page, I thought, wow, what a wonderful feeling. So I ran back to the same bookstore and I found Lauren Bacall's memoir by myself, and I actually found a signed copy. So I went and devoured that one right afterwards. So I don't always have much time to devote to it, but I can't go without reading.
Well, there's one last note here. I'll get to it in a second. But before I do, I want to personally thank you so much for giving your time here today. It's been absolutely wonderful to have this conversation with you, and very enlightening.
Oh, I'm grateful. Thank you.
And you really sound like a great guy. And here's the last point. Debbie, our new president, I might say, just recently elected.
Congratulations, Debbie.
Debbie from Arizona wants to thank you for coming. And she says this. She wants to be one of the first to wish you a happy birthday on Monday.
God bless you. I so appreciate it. I tell you, you know how I'm going to celebrate? Thank you, Debbie. It means the world to me. I appreciate it so much. My birthday this last year, I turned 50, and my girlfriend threw me, my girlfriend and our production manager, Gina, an old friend of mine from high school, they threw me, it was the best night of my life. They threw me a surprise party with 200 friends and family, and authors were there, and some authors, Nelson among them. He sent in a video from across the country. Brad Meltzer sent a video. Greg Hurwitz sent a video. It was wonderful, and they rented out the Silent Movie House in Los Angeles, and they gave me a This Is Your Life night, you know, to celebrate, to toast and roast me.
Wonderful.
And so I tell you, every day since has been a new adventure. So Monday, thank you. We've got some time carved out where I'm going to be getting together with Robert Hicks, who's a marvelous author. He wrote Widow of the South and many other historical novels. And he is out at a writer's conference maybe 100 to 200 miles from here. And amazingly, we have the same birthday. We're going to we're going to celebrate together on Monday and have a great night.
That's cool. Thanks so much, Scott.
So thank you for your well wishes.
And good luck with your current assignment. And I hope it's enjoyable and goes well. And thanks so much for giving your time today.
Of course. It's my pleasure, my privilege, and thank you all. Thank you all for listening. It means the world to me that you spend that time with me.
Take care.
So I'm honored. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.